Welcome to Think Big for Africa podcast. On this podcast, we will bring you interesting conversations with local, national, and international African leaders from all walks of life, home and abroad. Leaders who are doing their bits to progress Africa's development. Conversation topics will range from education, science, health, leadership, politics, business, and many other global issues. Conversations about everything that concerns Africa's development. Africa has so many wonderful achievers worldwide, and this is exactly what we will bring to you on Think Big for Africa podcast. Stay tuned.
Hello, this is the Think Big for Africa podcast. This is Sekene Banye, your host. Today, I have a good friend, an author, an entrepreneur. Well, we're going to have a good conversation. His name is Osareti Gobadia. Osat, how are you?
Oh, no, how are you doing? How are things?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good to finally catch up.
Yeah. I mean, thank you for being here today. I know you're busy, you know? Now, let's start this way. Tell my audience about you and your work. Let's start this way. Yep.
Okay, that question's always about me. I know why we always try to talk about ourselves. About me?
Yes, about you.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm a father. Husband, entrepreneur. I founded a company called an infrastructure and technology firm about 15 years ago.
You've been static.
Oh, wow. When we were joking and talking, he didn't do that. So
exactly. So now we're talking. He does that.
So, father, husband, entrepreneur. I founded a company in Nigeria, infrastructure and technology firm about 15 years ago called DBH Africa.
Yeah.
I'm currently taking a sabbatical. I mean, this COVID period seems like a good time to take a break, taking a sabbatical and volunteering with government at the very moment. I like to call myself an aspiring farmer because it really I'd rather be on the farm and growing some kind of some crop that matters. So I refer to myself as an aspiring farmer. Mm. That's pretty much it.
Okay. So I introduce you as an author. You co-authored a book, a nice book with a good friend of ours.
Yes.
Chukwuma Chukwuka. And on this book, you have a podcast with a friend of yours, Jumoke, I guess.
Yes.
So the book is called In Pursuit, Journeys of African Entrepreneurship. Tell me.
Yes.
Tell my audience about the book and maybe why you guys wrote this book and what are you trying to drive at from young Africans who want to get into entrepreneurship?
Yeah. So, I mean, the book itself is actually a testament in entrepreneurship, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Chuka and I, you know, basically sitting down right before the what we call the election, post-election break that tends to happen in Nigeria after elections. And, you know, I basically convinced him for us to put some thoughts on paper and write a book. So we basically did that. And after writing this book, you know, we started researching, you know, the approach. How do you release a book, right? You get published or you do self-publishing. After we reviewed it for a while, you know, the self-publishing was a lot more exciting to us because you basically had to learn the process.
Yeah, he told me.
And execute yourself. But we were like, nah, we're not. Because to publish a book, you actually have to market the book, pitch it to people.
Yeah.
It's like looking for a record deal. You know, two busy entrepreneurs. Too busy. You're not just busy. two busy, very quiet entrepreneurs, right? Who are not really media in the media, just quietly doing their work.
Yeah.
It, you know, it's almost impossible for somebody to come look at your book and say, this is the book they want to publish. Mm. So you would have to do a lot of work to get it. Yeah. But we quickly understood that we wanted to take the self-publishing route. How do you hop to actually releasing the book? Then came COVID, right?
Yeah.
Then came the COVID lockdown. And the COVID lockdown presented like what we refer to it to ourselves as the best reading opportunity ever.
Yep.
Right? You know, when it first started, you know, we didn't know how long we're going to be under, but it started to become very evident that we're going to be there for a while.
Yeah.
We debated heavily on should we release a book now? People are distracted. People are worried. But we came to the point that, you know, this is the best time. People are home. They're looking for things to do. They're going to get tired of television. They're going to get tired of, you know, just looking for something to step out of themselves. And a good book would be a great thing to do. So we released the book during COVID, went through the entire process of publishing to marketing to creating content. One thing that hits home to me is that, you know, a lot of the people we worked with during that period.
Yeah.
So I'll say what's interesting about a lot of people we worked with on the book, we actually never met them, and some of them we still haven't met. Right? So it was a very interesting period where you're looking for people to do XYZ, book cover design, book design, content development. You know, we didn't meet, you know, a lot of these people.
Yeah.
And we worked with them virtually, you know, paid them, worked with them virtually, and they did their work. And that's that. So today, we have not met a lot of these people. So that was very interesting how that period actually moved and transformed things, you know, forward on how work is done, right? Yeah. So we went through that entire process, and it was something quite interesting that, you know, while we're still trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to deploy this book into the market, we started creating content, right? We did things like we created a market series where we, you know, went to the market and we interviewed people in the market. We did things like we took pictures. So these are all things we just did, just saying, interesting that we just say just in case we need them.
Yeah.
Right? So it was not during COVID. We now started editing them and creating them to the content that was now released.
Right? Nice.
So it's like just that whole being prepared. It's like almost like we knew COVID was coming, right?
Yeah.
We had all this content we have created and we're able to use it during COVID to help promote the book.
That's nice.
So I mean, the book itself has done quite well. I mean, we're somewhere under 5,000 books. I mean, that's not the enormous number, but you know, if that's in a year, and we're hoping that as we continue to
promote it, talk about it,
promote it, yes, it will get to a tipping point where, you know, it starts to move on its own. Right now, it's doing some things in the market, and we're quite happy about that.
And
well,
now,
to answer your question,
yes, your podcast on the same subject, you guys know,
so. You know, there's a question you asked. I'm going to answer in a second, but let me answer this podcast question. The podcast, interestingly enough, started sort of the same way, right? Mm-hmm. Apart from the fact that a podcast is like a natural, you know, move from a book, a natural extension from a book. It actually came about from just conversations during COVID, right? So myself, Chimoke, a friend of mine from Nigeria, who was in London during COVID, we talked. Every now and then we'll have a conversation. We'll talk about podcasts that we're listening to that is helping us, you know, spend the time. Chuka, we'll talk about yours. And, you know, we go about just thinking about what we're going to do. And we say, hey, let's do a podcast. So the podcast you are listening to now, I don't know if you pick up on the timeline in it, and we try to edit it to make sense for any time, was actually recorded during COVID.
Ah.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
During the heart of COVID, we were recording. We found that, and we were all in three different places, right? So we found an app that allowed us to do that, right?
Yeah.
Chuka was in the States, in mm-hmm. Dallas. Chuka was in Dallas. When we did the podcast, Chuka was actually sitting in Dallas. I was sitting in Delaware in the US, and Jumoke was in the UK. So we were able to do this over an application that we found to help us create the content.
Yeah.
You know, after creating the content, we started around with it for a while, trying to figure out how we were going to, you know, release it to the market, and then we ultimately chose the short format, 25 minutes to use. But it was interesting. I mean, ultimately, why we do any of these things, right? Why write the book? Why create a podcast? One thing the book and the podcast have in common is that we wanted to make our time count. Mm. Right? We ultimately, it goes beyond the fact that we had something to say. The writing the book came from a place of, you know, we wanted to make the time count. What are we going to do with this time? Let's write a book. And I think, and it's such a task, right? You think
yeah.
Chose.
Yeah,
we need to choose to go do something else. So the book actually is it's a way to tell our future selves, what we're doing, right?
Yeah.
Tell our future selves the African story, right? Because ultimately, what's happened is that we're trying to apply things that don't really fit our environment to us, right? So it's critical that African entrepreneurs tell their story.
Yeah.
To ensure that we have that we are on the right page.
Good. See, people telling their stories is something that we Africans need to understand and imbibe. See, right now, most African youths who want to be entrepreneurs, they don't. Well, maybe until recently, they don't look at one African who has made it. They look at somebody in the US.
Yeah,
because that's mostly because we don't write books.
Yeah,
see, every Tom, Dick, and Harry who has made £10,000 or dollars. In one venture, we write a book, in the West, and that writing books and reading books are some of the easiest way to communicate new things to the general public. And we are not very good at it, even our presidents, you see. How many of our presidents in Africa has written books? I mean, we have that difficulty. Our leaders don't write books. In business, they don't write books. So it's very, very important that we start doing that. And I appreciate the book. In fact, I asked Chukwuma earlier today, hey, when are you guys going to come up with the audio version? Because even though I've read this book, I've read some pages, I can't read the whole book because I have reading difficulties. So I asked him, hey, when is the audio going to come? Well, he said to me that whenever he is in the same space with you, that you guys will sit down and record the audio. So I'm waiting. I'm really,
yeah,
really waiting.
The audio book.
Yeah.
The audiobook is one that's gonna get its own stage, because one of the things, I mean, you've read the book. I just had a conversation with Chuka and one of our partners in our publishing media company now about just getting somebody to do the audio. Mm. And they both yelled at me. Both of you have to do it. Yeah, if you've read the book, you realize that both of us have to do it.
It's a conversation. Yeah. So you guys You guys need
so,
to sit down, talk about it.
We'll be patient. And, exactly.
Yeah.
We'll be patient and get it on. So, I mean, ultimately, what you were just talking about is, in a book, if you read the book, there's a concept of 300 missing pages.
Yeah.
Right? And, people, when you hear 300 missing pages, you just think it only applies to incomplete stories, as in your story is not complete or you stole money or something like that.
It doesn't matter.
The truth of the matter is, another variant of 300 missing pages is when we are reading books that don't apply to us.
Mm-hmm.
You're a first-year person, but you're reading a book that a director is reading. You're not ready. Read the first-year book. If you want to be advanced, read the second-year book. Then maybe that's what will get you. Or on the other hand, you read a book and the entrepreneur, the first thing he says is, I started my business in a garage. We don't have garages.
Yes.
In Nigeria, we have gatehouses.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And the gate man is there with his family, So you cannot necessarily say that you're gonna start your business next to his family and his cooking utensils. So it's critical that it's critical that our leaders and our entrepreneurs write their story. And we believe this so much to the fact that Chuka and I and the guy named Ayo, we started a company to help people, you know, develop their books, create the books, and publish the books, and of course, market the books to the market, because we think it's important.
Yeah, it's very, very important. Now, well, right now, I wouldn't be asking you something that's it's strange. Right now, you are an entrepreneur, and you are trying to get young Africans to develop the habits of entrepreneurs. Okay. Now, I know there's so many great habits of entrepreneurs. Just give us five or six habits that are very, very important to be for successful entrepreneurs.
So that question is always interesting to me, because I actually see it from the other direction, right? You know, anytime I'm asked that question, I'm always thinking the whole born versus bred.
Okay.
As in, are you born to do this, or are you trained to do this?
Okay.
And that thought makes you think about what skill sets are you born with, and how does that skill set apply to your idea?
Okay.
So I want to disconnect that. In my opinion, is a fallacy, right? Thinking that these skill sets you are born with means you cannot do this idea.
Yeah.
Right. To more so look at it from the other way, to think of it, what skill set do I need to acquire to be able to do this idea?
Okay.
Do you understand?
Great.
So I would say over time, I've come to learn that there are several things that could prevent you from being successful. So it is more so identify what those things are and acquiring them, as opposed to taking the position of, if I'm tenacious, then I'm a good entrepreneur. If I'm intelligent, then I'll be a good entrepreneur. If I'm flexible, then I'm a good entrepreneur. These are all things you can actually acquire. Depending on the idea that you're trying to execute, right? So I think it's critical that the skills that we believe we need, right, depending on the idea you're trying to execute, and depending on what you don't have, you go learn them, or get them by partnership.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Right? So we have this thing where we say, you have to partner your weakness.
Yeah. Right?
So if you want to do a podcast, but you don't know how to work sound, you go and learn how to work sound.
Yeah, or get somebody
So you have to start mixing in, talent and skills as commodities that you can bring together, learn or acquire. But I would always say that, one of the key things that some of the key things people have to understand is that business, the thing that runs the idea, right, is actually a science.
Okay. Okay.
Right? Which means you have to learn. Right? You have to learn. So I give an example. One thing that always gets me, maybe I'm telling my secret now. balance sheets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every time I read a balance sheet, and this is crazy for somebody who invests with other people, every time I read a balance sheet, I actually am relearning every time. It's almost like it's the first time I'm seeing one.
Mm.
Right? It's amazing to me. I've seen it several times. I know what it's supposed to do. But every time I see it, it sort of intimidates me.
Yeah.
And I feel like I have to go read up on something to ensure what I'm reading is what I'm understanding.
You get it.
So I can give the right advice. It happens every time, right? And a lot of times I just send it to my wife. She's an accountant. I send it to her. I send it to my wife. She explains it to me again, which she never gets tired of explaining to me. I mean, she's explained balance sheets to me. I've sat on board where in the board meeting where I read balance sheets. Before the board meeting, I would take the balance sheet and go and study balance sheets again so that I can understand I'm able to be effective. So it's a learning and relearning process. Nobody's too big for it, right? Here I am. I've been on boards. I've been on people's advisors to companies that have been successful. I have my own company. In fact, in my own company, I was the COO. All accounting reported to me, and I'm saying that I learn balance sheets every time. When this thing really hit me again was today, because somebody sent me one. They sent me one, a whole strategy on a merger, And I was looking at numbers and I had to say to myself, again, balance sheet. You know, how is it that after all these years, I've been learner, a continuous learner on balance sheet. So people are expecting me to have input.
See, what you are saying is so, so important. See, a lot of our young people who want to be entrepreneur, what you are saying is so important for them. That tells them you can learn one thing and relearn it tomorrow and learn it all the time.
Yeah.
So never be too big to learn. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Oh God.
I've been working for over 25 years. You know, I've been running a business for over 15 years. And I'm telling you that I relearn balance sheets every day. Every time I see it, I'm like, that's good. What does this mean? So, but the one of the key things, right? So the number one major habit of all entrepreneurs, right? The one that actually makes you an entrepreneur, right? So you could be a person who has ideas. You know, you have ideas. You could go work for somebody. The number one thing that actually differentiates you and makes you an entrepreneur is risk management, right? The taking on risk, right? That spirit of tenacity, right? Dexterity. And basically being able to take a step into the unknown, right?
Yeah.
And build the floor under you that you and your team are going to walk on. You know, that's what makes you an entrepreneur, right? You know, because ultimately you can be a visionary. Oh, I think in 5 years, you know, we're not going to turn light switches anymore. We're going to blink and the light is going to change. Fantastic vision.
Yeah.
But vision without action is a fantasy.
Nothing. Yeah.
Right? So what actually makes you an entrepreneur is not, you know, this is my actual answer to your five habits. Anybody who really can form an idea is fantastic. That's the first step. But is that taking that risk and being able to manage through that risk?
Yeah.
And being able to walk out and in that flawless place, be able to create steps for you to walk on that idea.
Yeah.
And bring people on board and make them believe in this your idea and gather them and keep building the floor in front of you is what makes you an entrepreneur.
Great.
Tenacity, dexterity, and ability to deal on risk.
Very good. Thank you. So, what's your take on the role of our governments, African governments, in encouraging entrepreneurship in our various countries?
So, that's a good one. So, there's a constant battle between regulation and innovation.
Mm.
It's a constant fight, right? Especially if you're in the tech space.
Yeah.
I would say government is meant to, and I believe in some instances, intends to build the track. So like I said a few seconds ago before we got cut off, you know, there's the when it comes to tech space, there's the battle between regulation versus innovation.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, government is meant to create the train tracks. Which your idea runs on. Okay. So your idea, your company is a train, right? Yeah. And that train is meant to move the economy forward.
Yeah.
It's meant to move the country forward. Government's job in that is to lay the tracks down.
Okay.
Now, where government does not lay the tracks down, your business model gets derailed.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
When government doesn't lay the tracks down in the right time, in the right way, towards the right direction, right? Or a direction that allows your company to go to the direction it wants, your idea gets derailed.
Yeah.
Right. So government's role is really to create the enabling environment.
Yeah.
Right. Enabling environment to allow us to develop great ideas, ideation to, I want to stop saying the word exit, you know, ideation to reinvestment.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Right. So, I don't think you are leaving. You know, from a government perspective, you know, we want you to reinvest after your idea has flourished, not exits.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So from ideation to reinvestment, you know, government is meant to create a path and manage through obstacles for companies to flourish, to be able to create value in the environment. And you know, and these things bring, you know, they bring a number of things. So I give you an example. So I told you that, you know, I'm volunteering with the government at the moment.
Yeah.
One of the things we're working on is the Nigerian Startup Bill. Now, the Nigerian Startup Bill is a direct response to the question, is government listening? Right? Is government responsive? Right? So governments, you know, basically pulled together a big tent, right? The big tech of tech-enabled ecosystem members, partners, associates, regulators, service provisioners, to co-create a framework, right, that would help, you know, that would help guide future interactions, provide incentives to aid growth and stability.
Yeah.
So these things are doable, right? So that's something we're working on right now. And ultimately, you know, when you create this incentive that helps businesses, you also look for them to reinvest through job creation, knowledge transfer, and you know, a number of other things. So it's that balance where you have a way where government and the companies, you know, collaborate to move the country forward. So your question is, what's Africa, you know, what's government's role in helping develop, you know, entrepreneurship? It's really creating these tracks, right? It's really creating this track to help support businesses, right? So when these ideas come up, they're not now stumbling through regulation and policies that are not enabling or not properly planned, but more so are basically pushing them towards the right direction and helping them move their idea from ideation to reinvestment is what's key. Just looking at that kind of pipeline.
Yeah, that's the role of the government. Okay, I agree absolutely. See, but what bothers me is this. In developed countries, the I would say the smartest people in society.
Last thing I heard was, I agree.
Oh, okay. I'm saying that in the developed countries, the smartest people they work in government.
Yeah.
Okay. They work in government. Okay. Let me rephrase it. The most educated people work in government. Mm-hmm. Okay. In the UK, for example, at least 80% of people who work in local government have first degrees. Okay. And maybe up to 50% have masters or PhDs. They are experts in what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, this is part of the way they can support an industry, because they have the capacity to learn and churn out policies and regulation to help that industry or to regulate that industry. See, for example, in Nigeria, for example, I don't know. See, I'm asking a question because I don't know. Do we have the knowledge in government to sit down with the techie guys and really understand what they are talking about? I'm not talking about the politicians. No. I'm talking about the civil servants.
Yeah. So,
do we have the people who understand the techie, all the technical issues in the space? And they sit down.
My answer is going to surprise you.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, we do.
Oh, I'm happy.
Yeah, we actually do. So, a few seconds ago, you were you were giving us statistics about, you know, the education levels of the British government.
Yeah.
I would say that the statistics in Nigeria would be about the same, if not higher.
That's right? Nice.
Yeah, because you have to look at the nature of Nigeria, right? Nature of Africans. We value education, right? So if you put
you say that, but the reality on ground to me is
it's when a soup doesn't taste right.
Okay.
Right? You know, I like food. Anybody who knows me knows I like food. When a soup doesn't taste right, right? It's not, I'm a foodie. You know, it's not just one ingredient that is off.
Yeah, okay.
Right? It takes a lot of things to make soup go wrong.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To go wrong. You know, sometimes when you put soup in front of you, we won't go into the depth of the soup. But ultimately, it's a number of things that gives you the results that you are looking at. But if you start speaking to specifics, do we have very educated civil service? I would tell you yes. PhDs and, you know, MBAs and the like. That's a different conversation. We're not going to go into the details of where and how and what, you know, and so forth. What I would tell you is that some of the problems that you do see is from a lack. You said it a few minutes ago. Do you have the people to sit down? What I would tell you is that the lack of sitting down is part of the problem.
Ah, okay.
That's sitting down.
So is the process that is the problem?
Exactly. Okay. It's not that they are not capable people, very capable hands that we have in the Nigerian government. But sometimes it's the processes that puts things on the wrong rail. I think the question ultimately is one of execution.
Yeah. Execution. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't like ideas in Africa. We don't like ideas. We have ideas. We know what needs to be done, right? We have brilliant minds, right? But we, however, are yet to find the right balance of governance to produce the right rate of progress for us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If we're finding a system that works for us. Right now, we're still borrowing from here, borrowing from there. You know, we need to develop our own approach that matches our own cultural temperament.
I will tell you this. Yeah. After this podcast, I will tell you. In fact, let me just say it now.
Drop it.
See. This is it. We have borrowed a lot of things, but we have not. To me, this is my view. I don't think we have ever sat down to ask ourselves the question: what do we actually need? Okay. Now we are running what's it called now? A presidential government like America, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we need two arm legislator? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. What do we need? A Congress and a Senate? All they do is to take away all the money that the doctors who are trying to migrate to Saudi Arabia should be getting. That's what the people in Congress are getting. Okay. Now,
I would I would say we just walk away from all the other various reasons why the soup doesn't taste good, right? you know, I wouldn't say, you know, we're a very, very, very blessed country. I don't think anybody has the capacity. There's more than enough, right?
I get disheartened because I know we have the capacity if only we use it correctly. But then, like you say, the process is a problem.
Mm.
So we need to sit down and ask ourselves what process will work for us.
It's an African-wide problem.
I'm using Nigeria because we're Nigerians.
Yeah, as a proxy.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a proxy. I mean, have you ever listened to or read up on the whole OOU formation? You know, the
I read some stuff,
like the two different parties, you know, the Nkrumah party, you know, what they were fighting about. You know, when you look at that, you know, a lot of things go bad from the structure, from the, right? Yeah, how you are set up.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you bring the smartest people and put them in those positions. It's just like football. If your coach gives you the wrong formation, if you like bring Ronaldo and Messi and put them there, you have Ronaldo playing defense. Yeah, you're not going to, you know what I mean? So, I mean, the talent will push through and you get one-offs, but the formation is wrong. So that's why I say that, you know, sometimes we need to walk away from the symptoms and try to go to the root causes and look at how we are set up.
Yeah.
Ultimately we're Africans, right? We're not Europeans. We're not Americans, right? We need to look at, you know, what works for us, what kind of government and what kind of governance and what kind of processes and procedures that we need in Africa to move us forward, right? The lot of things that you see happening are all the symptoms, right? And, you know, sometimes when you dissect these symptoms, it just takes you to the wrong place. So in my opinion, it's always the wrong place to start. So I've sort of seen the Wizard of Oz action on the front end and the magic he performed. And I've now gone behind the curtain and I've seen Wizard of Oz pulling the chains. And I can come and tell you for a certainty that, you know, if we continue to jump at symptoms, we will waste our time and nothing will happen in our lifetime. But if we start making moves to understand that the decisions are made in the trenches, the issues are is it that of formation, that our process is off and we need to engage to realign so we get somewhere, we won't get anywhere, right? We'll just be talking about the symptoms.
Mm.
And the symptoms are very juicy. The symptoms are very, very
and plenty. Right? And plentiful.
And plenty. Yeah, and plentiful. So I no longer have concern about the symptoms. It wasn't precisely because you were talking about NAS. To me, that's a symptom. I move away from symptoms and I focus on what are the root causes. What is the underlining thing that can move this, you know, demonstrably to the right direction?
Yeah.
And that's what we all need to focus as intelligent Africans. To move Africa forward, to put our place in the right position in the world.
That's good. See, because one of the things for me, people around the West are always talking about capitalism, socialism. Me, I'm not interested in those arguments. See, anything that works, I can take it and adapt it. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in capitalism, socialism. Both of them work in if they are, both of them have pieces that work.
What do you call China? If you wanna hold on to these labels, right? Is China really communist or is it capitalist?
Capitalist? China is a market-driven economy right now, and they have been market-driven since the 90s. Okay.
Yes.
They are governed by a political party that says they're socialists. Okay, but that same Socialist Party is the same party that agreed and developed capital-driven economy that pulled 65% of their population out of poverty.
Exactly.
So China is doing what works for them.
Exactly. That's it right there.
Yeah, and that's what Africa should do. What works for them. See,
exactly. Take
both of them, pick the things that will work for us.
Yeah.
Instead of labels are useless.
Yeah.
All they do is distract you.
Exactly. Labels serve to distract you. This is a communist idea or socialist idea. It's a waste of time.
That the bottom line is this. That's what got Afghanistan where it is. Yeah. Because
democratic versus
No. Capitalism, socialism. That's what happened in Afghanistan in the 60s and 70s. Okay. Yeah. That's the basis of the trouble that the Russians came in to support their socialist group in Afghanistan. And how is Afghanistan today? It's in disarray.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to make sure doesn't happen to us.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
100%.
Anyway, so, in fact, this topic, this question I'm going to ask you, it's about brain drain, okay?
Oh, yeah.
See?
We're back at the 1980s now.
Well, it's... I am in this country. I'm in the UK today.
Mm-hmm.
Courtesy of a policy of the UK government that allowed me to leave Nigeria to come to the UK and work here. Okay. And this, there are so many other people who also took advantage of those things to leave their various countries and come to the West.
Yeah.
In fact, before we started, okay, I was in a seminar, a 2-hour seminar about brain drain. You know, now let's even just go back to what the Honorable Minister of Labor and Employment in Nigeria said some weeks ago, I think. He was being interviewed on Channel TV, and he said Nigeria has abundant doctors. According to him, Nigeria has abundant doctors. That those ones who want to go, let them go. Let them go and repatriate the foreign currencies. This evening, I heard from Dr. Osanho, I can't pronounce his name, but it's supposed to be I've forgotten again. But it's a top guy in the medical labor movement. Let me put it that way. Osanho Ena Belele, something like that. Sorry if I mispronounce the name, but he said this. According to the standard, okay, which the World Health Organization goes by, Nigeria is our medical doctors were in deficit of 280,000 doctors. Deficit.
Yeah.
So the question is, how can our Minister of Labor and Employment tell us that our doctors can go and repatriation dollars and pounds and whatever, when I know for a fact that if I was in Nigeria, I had a stroke 10 years ago. If I was in Nigeria when it happened to me, I most likely wouldn't be here to talk to you today.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've all had our health scares. I think this was one of the conversations that we had recently where we spoke about the different reasons, you know, families no longer live in Nigeria and so forth. And we all know the issues with the healthcare system and so forth. I cannot dare speak to the context in which the Honorable Minister was coming from.
Okay.
For several reasons. One, I wasn't there. Two, I didn't get the question he was asking.
Okay.
Three, I don't know what the presentation was about. I think there's some point to be made about the volume of doctors that are produced in Nigeria due to the cost of, you know, the overall cost of a medical degree in Nigeria.
Yeah.
That's another conversation for another day. You know, some would argue that the education is too cheap, which creates an imbalance in the market. It's subsidized. Mm. And that may be why it's subsidized on the other end. But that's an economics question for the economists to answer on how changing the supply will improve the outputs, or how changing the supply would improve the quality of lives of those that do achieve something that should be really difficult. That's one way to look at it. But I would say this, you know, I answer the question from what I believe, right? You know, I think Nigeria's most valuable resources are our people.
Okay.
And we tend to get that confused a lot. We think it's oil. We think it's natural resources in our ground. It's our people. Our people are our most valuable resources. And how we reinvest in them and is key to our success. So when we lose one, you know, just one, it's already too much, right? So when one person moves out of Nigeria, it's already too much. As you probably have already seen on our podcast, right? In Pursuit podcast, shameless plug.
Yeah.
You hear we talk about migration.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. In our book, we spoke about migration as well. One thing that you have to know that is true to human nature is that when the ground under you no longer supports you, you will move.
Yeah.
So
that's natural.
That has been true since man who was killing and planting, you know, killing and hunting and gathering. It's been true from there.
Yeah.
When the water starts running, they move.
Yeah.
When the animals are not going a different route, they move.
Yeah.
When the ground dries up and it can't grow staple food, they grow it, they move. So the migration and brain drain is a direct representation of the inability of the ground to sustain people. And you have to ultimately look at the amazing things that Nigerians do, Africans do,
everywhere
when they go to other grounds. It's gotten to the point now that when I get emails or posts about Nigerians doing amazing things, I'm no longer impressed. I'm somewhat feeling sad because I think about these are our treasures. This is the value that Africa has to offer.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat dissipated because it's all over the world as opposed to being concentrated on our soil to create value here. So I would never support a statement that says, please go and bring back. It's not about money. It's about creating value. So I don't know what to do with the... I can't really answer the Honorable Minister's comment because I wasn't there. But I can speak from what I believe in.
Yeah. So, you see, in this seminar, we talked about brain drain and then... See, this is a conversation I've been having with many people, okay? That what can Africa diaspora do? What contribution can we make to help the development of Africa? And I suddenly believe that we are very important. See, if we want Africa to develop, if we want Africa to develop, then those of us outside Africa need to work together with those inside Africa to make it happen. You see, there are various difficulties, okay, that is stopping us from working together, but it's imperative that we work together. What's your take on that?
So once again, I think this is one of those situations where it's how it's defined, right? When we think of diasporans, we think them versus us, us versus them, as opposed to understanding that, you know, they take oil out of our ground and bring it back to us. They take our people out of our ground. They don't necessarily bring them back to us. So that's a resource that we are losing, that we have lost. So if you look at people who are outside of the continent as natural resources to the continent, then you may be able to create programs and systems to be able to tap into their value to help the continent. You know, these people are intelligent, they are skilled, they are talented, exposed, tested, experienced, and educated, right? You know, very valuable resources. We want them to come back home in any form or fashion and to contribute to nation building. It's very important. Yeah. They should come, you know, any way you want to do it. Either you're coming for, you know, government has set up a two-week program where you come in 2 weeks, you train people, you go back. Any form of fashion. The problem is that we're not currently looking at it as a resource that we must invest in and reposition back on the continent. That's where the problem starts, right? Mm. We also look at it as, oh, they are there and they should send money back.
Yeah.
And they come for Christmas. That's sort of where we leave it. And the other part is it's not seen in a complete view, right? You know, I do mean all African diaspora.
Yeah.
You know, either they left by plane or they left
by ship. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's my view too.
They left with passports or they were kidnapped.
Yeah. That's my view.
Yeah.
That's my view.
So it's they are all our valuable resources. And if you look at the generality of the value that the African diaspora has created in the world, if you bring that value and refocus it back on the continent, you know, we will take our rightful place. You know, that's part of the problem. We don't realize that the continent has been derailed by our resources being depleted, right, taken from us. And if we don't start looking at people as the number one resource, we don't really see them as a depletion. That's when we're not saying, well, at 200 million now, if another 100 million are outside, what do we need them for?
Exactly.
But that 100 million on the outside, they are creating value that we are not creating in here.
Well,
right?
See,
they are literally the top 100 million, maybe.
Yeah. See, I was talking to my in-law this evening, and I brought up this conversation. And he says, well, if I go to Nigeria, like I've done before, to start something. And when before I had my health issue, I registered a company with two friends of mine in Nigeria, and I wanted to get a shirt maker in London for them to allow us to be their distributor in West Africa.
Okay. Yeah.
So I registered this company. I did it. It was my idea. I only called these guys, say, hey guys, this is what I'm thinking. I want to leave banking in 2 years. So this is what I want us to do. And I registered the company. I put the name on the paper. Let's do it together. Unfortunately, I got sick. So when I left the hospital, I went to Nigeria and I was at my father's house. They came to see me. Fine. Then I couldn't speak. I couldn't speak at all. You know, it took me nearly 4 years to be able to speak. Now, unfortunately, what this guy did was to remove my name from the company I registered. They removed my name without my knowing. Unfortunately, I was the person who contacted the company. So they came back to me and they told me, oh, this. Unfortunately, because they removed my name and I wasn't in the place to do anything, I couldn't hand the thing back to them to work on. See, this is the issue. Many of our people, they don't understand this collaboration with us, that we should work together to build something. Many of us in diaspora who have tried to do something back home, and the people we relied on only wanted to chop. And this is the issue for us.
Yeah. So that ultimately is a symptom, right? That would happen in any environment where you're fooled to believe that the lack is what's sustainable. That is always not going to be enough.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, as we do a number of things. So like I said earlier, the symptoms prevent us from solving the problems, right? So the symptom of the fact that you are likely going to get, you know,
shafted
by the, you know, by the person that you know, there've been several stories. You know, you sent money home to do the house, you come back, there's no house, there's no land, but the person you send the money to, he built the house, he has a car that's
paying.
But you chop your money with that, I mean. But you know, there's stories like that, and interestingly enough, there's stories that are successful that people just don't tell the stories. So all you hear is the negative stories, right? So it's one of those things where if we start to solve the problems, if we create a platform for diasporans to invest without going through that path, and it now creates jobs, it will reduce the amount of these situations happening, right?
What you just said was the solution that someone, the professor of economics on that seminar gave, that we create a platform that people in diaspora can invest, that will create jobs and all that.
Yeah, it's all about intentions, right? So if you look at the people in diaspora as resources, and you want to tap into that resource, you create a platform where you get them to volunteer their holiday. Maybe you want to do holiday. Okay, no problem. We'll pay for you to come to Nigeria. But when you get here, you do 1 hour a week in our hospital. You do 2 hours of teaching.
Exactly.
For your trip.
Yeah.
I know of personally of people, and this is something it's not like I thought about this before. I'm just saying this while we're doing this podcast.
Exactly.
It's common sense.
Yeah.
But that only comes about when we stop thinking about the symptoms and focus on what will resolve the actual problem to prevent the symptoms from continuing to happen. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So you gave me the symptom and I looked away from it. I went straight to what is the root cause. I mean, okay, the root cause is you want to be able to invest in your country and you want it to be a reliable pathway to do it. If you're able to do that, there will be jobs. That person who will have stolen your money will now be working. He doesn't need to steal your money. You understand what I'm coming from? Because, you know, people are also looking for ways to advance themselves. Unfortunately, it's not always, you know, the right path. So that's where that comes from.
Very good. Very good. Now, yes, I said, I wrote down some things. What kind of collaborative welfare programs and philanthropic initiatives are you involved in, you now? Because I know you do some things that you don't want to show me. Okay, so you need to tell my audience.
So we're back to talking about ourselves again.
We operate
in secret.
Yes.
if not for this book,
nobody will know.
Nobody will know, you know, and you know, sometimes, you know, and interestingly enough, that is why we have some of the problems we have.
Yeah.
Right. But we're not letting the stories of those who are quietly doing it to bubble to the top. All we hear.
I mean, when I had Chukuka, I knew he was doing so many things, but on the podcast was the first time I knew he was involved in movies.
Yeah.
You are doing so many things and no one knows.
Yeah. Quietly, as they say.
Yeah. So, what are you doing?
I mean, when you talk about social welfare and collaboration, this is the area that actually gets me excited. This is our farming, you know.
Ah,
I think is what I'm going to do.
Farmer.
I'm going to do when I'm rested. I have one small farm where I'm just planting small things here and I'll continue to do some things that excite me. So, you know, so one of the things that I've been focused on over the couple of years now is something called Edo Global.
Okay.
Edo Global Arts Foundation.
Okay.
Right. Edo Global Arts Foundation is a foundation located in Benin City.
Okay.
Right in the heart of Benin City, about, you know, we have about 3 floors that were taken up in the building. We intend to take up the entire building.
Which side of Benin is that? Which
side? It's on Sakumba Road. Road. Mm-hmm. Do you know Leventis? Do you know former Leventis?
It's been a long time I was there.
It's right by Ring Road.
Okay.
Really on Ring Road, yeah. Former Leventis building is right on the corner of Ring Road and Sakumba. Yeah. White building back in the day.
Yeah.
So we have an art tradition there that's pretty much a hub for arts, right? You know, the initiative is basically focused on developing and supporting next generation of Edo artists. And we've had a number of successes. You know, we have artists who have been featured on BBC, have won awards. We've had a number.
So let me know one or two. I'll bring them on my podcast.
Oh,
and we'll
definitely
talk about it.
Right after we finish this,
I'll give you
one or two names.
Very good.
Because it's an idea that's really close to my heart, because you know Edo Benin is a center of artistic talent and historic.
Yeah.
So to play a role in helping develop and give opportunities to young artists is a passion project that we're watching develop and grow. We've seen, and like I said, we've had a number of successes. We even have somebody who's going to the British Museum for a program, you know, a residency in a couple of months.
Good.
So
that's good.
Yeah. So you have all these young artists who are getting, you know, critically acclaimed. From there. I mean, when you go there, I mean, it's actually a must-see in Benin now. People go there, go to Benin for weddings, funerals. They stop by Edo Global on their way out. They check out the artists. You know, you basically go in and you have different artists, have different rooms. You walk in there, you see their work, and then you purchase what you want, or you maybe a program. We run a number of programs for students. We run programs for primary school students, university students, a number of other programs we've done in conjunction with museums around the world. A lot of museum directors have come to visit us to see what we're doing there. It's a very interesting project that's coming to life every day. And we thank God for what we're able to do.
Very, very good. Project. Very good. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
So this is my usual last question. See?
Oh, the last question.
My last question. I ask it to every guest of mine. I ask, what... You close your eyes, you see Africa in 20, 30 years. What do you see? What do you see?
The Africa of our dreams.
Okay. And what is that?
So, the problem with asking this kind of question to project managers, you know, and process managers, and people who do analysis, is that we don't want to belt out the fantasy because we see the problems.
Yeah.
Right. And the problems tend to keep us somewhat sedated, right, in what the potentials are.
Yeah.
What we want to do is we want to try to give our small part to solving the problem so that in 20, 13 years, you know, our children, they opt to live on the continent than to live somewhere else. Just the same way I told my dad I was moving to Nigeria. He was shocked at first, and then he gave me a pat on the back and say, you know, Godspeed and good luck in what you're trying to achieve there.
Very good.
So you would hope that you'd be able to create a place where your children would choose to live in Benin, as opposed to New York. And that is a prayer, and that's what we hope for. You know, when Africa truly ascends and rises, as opposed to the current dance that it's doing, where it goes forward, then it comes back, it goes sideways. You know, Africa rising, another label they used to do us with Juru, right?
Yeah.
When it's truly rising, ascending to where it belongs, you know. We hope for an Africa that lives to her potentials.
Yeah.
In her own way. That's what people don't tend to understand.
Mm-hmm.
In her own way, not in another person's way, in her own way, you know. We tend to, you know, it's very difficult to answer the question of what we expect when we're yet to embrace the issues, right? We don't want to embrace or understand that, you know, colonialism and the vestiges of colonialism, you know, still serve as a derailing factor.
Yeah.
You know, in Africa's growth, right? We're still dealing with the effects. Still dealing. I mean, we're talking about bring back our arts. You know, interesting enough, Edo Global, the project I spoke about a few seconds ago, is, you know, is indirectly involved in the Bring Back Our Arts.
And I'm happy. I'm happy to see major museums in Europe agreeing to bring back some stuff. That's good. Yeah. That's very good.
My partner in Edo Global, Notable Webo, is actually very key in that project. He's been working on it for a couple of years. So we're very aligned. The project is very aligned with, you know, part of the reasons why. So let me tell you a story real quick about this art thing. So I was in the studio of one of our artists recently, and she was trying to, from a picture, she was trying to do bronze work of a piece that was done hundreds of years ago, right? That sits in the British Museum.
Now, one of those pieces they stole.
They stole, before they started kidnapping.
Yeah.
Right? She was using a picture. Both of us were looking at this picture. We were trying to understand what was on the
other side.
We couldn't identify what the design was.
Okay.
We were looking for a picture. So part of the reason why we're doing a double over is that when these art pieces come back and you go to the museum in the initiative to look at the pieces that now arrive, and you want to recreate it, Edo Global will be the place where you have a studio to recreate it.
Yeah.
You are no longer looking from a picture. You are now looking at the actual artifact. So that's the difference. And a lot of people don't realize that these artifacts weren't just art. They are part of our history.
Yeah. Oh, see, so, that's how we represent our history. You know, exactly. With the carvings of kings and, you know? Yeah.
Exactly. So this is what I mean when I say we're still dealing with the effects, you know, we're still dealing with, you know, colonialism and its vestiges, right? We're still dealing with the effects, you know, of our prized possessions, you know. And when I say prized possessions, I mean people being ripped away from us, art, our history, and our natural resources. Some of these things are still in process, still being ripped away from us. So, you know, this is not an excuse. It's not an excuse, you know, but it's a fact. It's something we have to embrace to enable us to maintain a plan. Yeah, we have to embrace it before we can now say, okay, now we can plan for the Africa of our dreams.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Otherwise,
we're in dreamland.
And you see, exactly what I was about to say. Otherwise, you are fantasizing.
Yeah.
Right? So it would have been very easy for me to just postulate, well, you know, Africa of my dream. I look forward to Africa that looks like, what's that movie again? The one that we were excited about. The one that everybody talks about now, they refer to Africa now, the movie that the Marvel movie.
I don't know. See, me, yeah, I've lost many, many.
So you two of us just proved how old we were. The Marvel movie that recently was released a couple of years ago about Africa.
Panther. What was it? Black Panther.
Black Panther, exactly. So what's interesting about Black Panther, and most people don't realize, sometimes people create art. And in the creation of the art, it's like things get infused in. And sometimes they don't intend to do it. So if you think about Black Panther started with looking at the Benin art that was stolen. And then it took us to Africa that we don't have.
Yeah.
That we were deprived of.
Yeah.
Which means was also stolen from us. So ultimately, that's what Africa would have been if not for colonialism, right? We'd arrive at our own modernization, our own way.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have gotten things that we didn't need. Like, you know, thank you for your fridge, but maybe we didn't need a fridge. Do you understand? You know, maybe we didn't need a fridge. We had other ways of cooling. You know, maybe we would have created another way of cooling our food, which we had by then. You know, I have people who come on your podcast and tell you about the different ways we cooked food, the pots that kept water cold, and a number of ingenious ways we did things back then.
My grandmother's house, okay?
Yeah.
My grandmother never went to school, okay? She died at 96, 94, about 12 years ago. Okay.
Okay.
But her room, she has a pot, big pot.
Yes. That's the calabash now.
See, I just dip my cup in there, drink
always
cold water.
Yes. And you know the clay purifies the water.
Yeah.
It purifies the water. Yeah. So we'd arrived at our own sense of modernization, you know, in our own way, in our own time. So I think to answer your question more directly, you know, I hope for us to embrace our issues and set a path to arriving at where our potentials as a continent is what I think I most desire 20, 30 years. Not that we are still in the same position.
Yeah.
Where we're still in denial of what's happening and accepting what's being handed down to us.
Yeah.
Back to us, really, because it's ours in the first place. You know, and these issues are, you know, they sit in almost everything we say. You know, if you think about it, the question you asked me earlier is kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, let them go and they'll send money back. But there are resources to start with, right? So you can see how not embracing the problem continues to keep us in this position that we are. So it's just really hope that we embrace our issues and set ourselves on a course that gets us there.
Good, good, good. Authority, thank you very much. I'm honored that you agreed to do this. Thank you.
No, this was a good time. Thank you very much.
Man, thanks. Guys, this is Authority Gobadia, a good friend, and our conversation has been very, very interesting. You know, I've laughed more than I've done in 2 months on this podcast. All right, bye guys, bye.
Listen or watch more episodes of Think Big for Africa podcast with new guests every week. Subscribe to ensure that you are notified whenever new episodes are available.